Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. I'm really thrilled today to be joined by the now Baroness Joan Bakewell, legendary television presenter, broadcaster, writer, journalist, who I've admired from a distance for a long time. Joan, it's lovely to have you here. And I know you've been involved in talking about death and dying for a while now, haven't you?
The BBC invited me to do a series called We Need to Talk About Death. We're on Radio 4. And in the course of that, of course, I learned a lot myself about how people regarded death and the various things associated with it, the sort of problems that crop up that you might like to talk about now when you're feeling healthy and your family can confront it, rather than when you're fading away, when nobody really wants to talk about making arrangements. And so that programme made me wise to the idea that we should talk about it and make certain decisions.
And is it really the practical stuff that you care about, or are you also talking about the emotional side of it, the kind of deep conversation we never seem to have with our relatives?
Well, both matter, because unless you've sorted out the practical matters, you will be concerned about it and perhaps worry about it in your dying days. But I do think the nature of your dying days is important, and none of us will know what it feels like till we get there, of course. And those of us who go on to die don't live to tell the tale. So it's quite speculative, although it's informed. My programme was informed by psychiatrists and people who know as much as it's possible to know about what that's like.
And what did you learn? What are the main lessons you learned from that?
Well, the first one is to talk about it. Talk about it to your friend, your family and friends, close family particularly. Friends, if you can, if it's appropriate, at the right time, but not to obsess about it, obviously. I just think it's important to make arrangements, things like wills, legacies, letters you might want to write, messages you want to leave after your death, things of that kind. It's worth thinking about.
And have you done all that?
Yes, I've done most of it. I keep thinking I ought to revise things as you get older and live longer than you expected. You think, oh, I might just amend my will, or I might leave a letter to so-and-so. I might remind my children to be in touch with so-and-so. And who's got the code number for my laptop, for example? That's something that people forget to hand on.
I think it's probably very important that the person who... we're all going to die, aren't we? Let's face it, everyone's going to die. But I think it's quite important that we initiate a conversation, don't you? Rather than waiting for our relatives to do it around us, because it's hard for them.
Oh, yes. I think my children were very wary of raising the topic with me, because I don't think they'd know what angle to take. Or they might think I suspected them of wanting to inherit what wealth I have. And also, it doesn't occur to them. They're busy living their lives. If you were ill, they might be concerned. They might talk to each other. But I think it's up to you to raise it with them, to show that you're not shy of the subject. The point is, you might indeed be shy of the subject, but it's better to say so than not to say at all, because otherwise you just bottle it up and it dies with you, and lots of issues might be unresolved. For example, I spent some time the other day deciding what hymns I want singing at my funeral. That was quite an interesting afternoon. Things of that kind, little ideas that occur to you that might indeed be some comfort to them when you've died, but nonetheless are of some comfort to you when you're dying, that you've made decisions. And then you don't, as you finally pass away, suddenly think, oh, I never did that. Oh, I never got round to that. And so that, I think that's quite nice to resolve.
I feel I care about this subject because I never really had the kind of conversation I would like to have had with my husband, Michael, when he was alive and able to talk about it. I feel that was his choice. He never wanted to talk about it. And because I was the younger one, I kind of left it to him. But I regret that now because there were so many good conversations we could have had about what a lovely life we'd had together and how wonderful it was to have had our lovely family and all those kind of things. We never really had that heart to heart.
It's quite difficult to raise. I mean, a lot of people who know that they might be in their final years, perhaps final months, simply make a decision they don't want to talk about it. And you have to respect that decision, if it's a particular decision. If you have the chance to raise the possibility, then it's quite a good idea to take that chance. And then if they back off and say, no, let's not go there, then you can wrap up the conversation. Otherwise, you might, you know, come round it in a circulocutory way. What do you think the children will be doing this time in 5 years? What money will they have, I wonder? I wonder if they'll move house. Will they be able to afford it? Have they paid off their mortgage? Things that, in a way, hint at the way you might resolve your life before you go.
That's a lovely idea. Have you got any other suggestions of how to broach the subject?
I live on my own now. I'm close to my children, and I have no problem raising it. And they would say to me, we don't want to talk about this, but I don't think it occurs to them to be that abrupt. If I wanted to talk about it, they'd say, well, what is there to say? What are you worried about? You know, have you written anything down? What do we have to be concerned with? So I think, and also I've left a piece of paper with all the names and addresses of people like accountants and lawyers and my agent. And so that they have a piece of paper with the phone numbers on that they can refer to the moment they need to.
And we all need to do that at even a young age, don't we, in case of a traffic accident or a plane crash or something?
Indeed, but not many of us get round to it, do we?
No. And what is it, do you think, that puts us off using the right language around death? I mean, we have done an episode for this podcast about all the euphemisms that we use. People very rarely say, my partner died. They usually say, I lost my partner, or somebody's passed on. Even people I find within the hospice movement still talk about passing.
I think that the use of the word loss is very appropriate, because, of course, a death is a tremendous loss for those who are left behind. The phrase left behind is itself telling, isn't it? So I think I don't think we have to be too scared of talking about passing on, or it's the euphemism that covers an embarrassment. It's also part of a tradition, very often born of religious faith. You've gone to another place, doesn't apply in my case, but people want to use terms like that as a sort of comfort in their own philosophy.
So you think we are all embarrassed about talking about it, do you?
Well, I think we have our own ways of disguising any shyness that we feel about it. I think it doesn't, I don't think we have to be too bold about it to show that we're brave. We can talk about, I am dying, I won't be here in a few months' time. I don't think we need to be that explicit, because there's a kind of discretion implicit in using euphemisms that aren't a matter of lying or deceiving yourself, but a way of protecting yourself and those around you who perhaps don't want it to be spelled out quite so baldly. I mean, nobody goes around choosing their coffin, or perhaps some do. Some people certainly do want to be buried in a wicker coffin, or they want to consider, I am quite interested in considering my funeral service. I think that would be quite interesting. I'd quite like that to be poetry. I'd like to have a say in what it was. So I don't find that depressing. I find that's part of life.
I was interviewing Rabbi Jonathan Remain recently, who was talking about assisted dying. And he raised the subject of the Victorians. He said the Victorians were so much better at death than we are, because it was out in the open and they all wore their black and they had people round to visit the dead. And he said they wouldn't talk about sex. We're the opposite. We talk about sex all the time, but we very rarely want to talk about death.
Yes, religions have got many good ideas, which, because in many cases we've abandoned religion, we've abandoned those ideas too. But for example, the Jewish tradition of sitting Shiva and sitting round in the days after someone has died is a marvellously therapeutic thing to do, as well as philosophically sound and reassuring for everyone. And that's a tradition we could use, even though we don't belong to that particular faith. And it's a coming together. It's a landmark moment rather than just a simple shuffling off. Dying is a very important part of life. We should, as I won't say make the most of it, but we shouldn't just neglect to observe it as a real rite of passage, not just for the person who's died, but for the family.
Because we do really brush it under the carpet, don't we? We have our funerals, and then it's legendary, isn't it? That friends and people kind of disappear after the funeral, and the bereaved are often left managing their loss alone.
There's quite a lot of insight about the depth and nature of mourning, and how it's supposed to really take about 2 years, isn't it, to recover from the loss of someone very close to you. I can understand that.
Have you ever suffered that kind of loss yourself?
Yes, my mother died when I was about 28. And I remember feeling the loss very internally, but feeling that the world expected me to pull myself together. And I remember sort of several months later finding myself in a corner weeping. And my husband saying to you, yes, but that's not surprising. You're still in a state of grief. And I hadn't quite appreciated how grief lingers and takes and has to be worked through. You can't simply throw it off after the funeral, say, well, that's done now. You can't do that. Grief lingers and needs to be dealt with.
And it is such a big thing, isn't it? I think until you've been through it yourself, people don't really understand how enormous a loss of somebody really close can be. I mean, I can remember when my mother died, being in the supermarket doing some shopping and thinking, why are these people caring about their normal everyday lives as if nothing's happened?
I know, it is very extraordinary, because it does take over. You over, and I don't think you should hurry your grief. I mean, the idea of pulling yourself together is abhorrent and it's insulting. I think you should, in a sense, live with your grief. I don't think you should embrace it voluptuously, you know, and really go into a deep and protracted state of mourning like, you know, Queen Victoria did. But I think to let it live within you is perfectly appropriate, and it will find its own time to go. And one day you will find the sun shining, you'll say, oh, what a lovely day it is today. And you go, oh, I wasn't meant to think that, but I do now, and it is a lovely day, and the garden's full of flowers. That's good.
I think there can be a bit of guilt involved in that, can't there? People think, oh, I'm laughing again. I didn't think I ever would.
Yes, well, that's a mistake, isn't it? Because we all will laugh again, given our own time scale. And some will laugh sooner than others. It doesn't mean we don't feel the grief. It's just a different spectrum of psychology that it operates in each of us.
Can you remember whether you learned any lessons from your research and your programs into how to behave around the bereaved, what the best thing to do and say for people is?
The important thing was to confront it and to read all the signals, not to jump in and be sympathetic, not to over-talk, not to project your own attitudes onto someone else who will have their own time scale and their own spectrum. They will or not want to talk, or they might not. So you have to listen. You have to read the signs and the signals that other people put out and respond to them in a sensitive way. Now, that's something you do need to learn to do, and you can only learn when the occasion arises. So it is rather demanding of us because it's not something you can practice.
I know exactly what you mean, because some people will want a lot of sympathy and the opportunity to cry and talk, won't they? And other people will want to just sort of get on with it.
Yes, and I think, you know, some people want to be alone with their grief, and other people will want to share and remember and talk and take out the family photographs and reminisce. And there are different ways of doing that. You never know who who will choose which pathway.
Thank you, Joan Bakewell, ever so much for sharing your thoughts and your advice. Some useful help in there. Thank you ever so much for joining us.
I've enjoyed it.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.